Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on December 5th, 2017. This talk is on the seven factors of awakening. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
The Galana Sutta. One evening, the Buddha, while lying ill, was approached by Sariputta's young... Sariputta is one of the senior monks by this time. Was approached by Sariputta's younger brother, Kunda. And this is not the... There's a few Kundas in there, so don't let this confuse you. The Buddha spoke directly to Kunda to plant the seed of understanding in his mind. Venerable Kunda, let these seven factors of enlightenment arise in your mind. These seven factors of enlightenment are well expounded and are cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. They bring perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. What are these seven? Mindfulness is a factor of enlightenment. Mindfulness is carefully taught by the Buddha. Mindfulness is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Mindfulness brings perfect understanding and full realization. And nibbana, awakening. The seven factors of awakening are taught in a few different suttas, but prominently in the Paticchasamuppada, not the Paticca, the Satipanna Sutta, the Sutta on the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, and in the Anapanasati Sutta that we'll be looking at next week. And in both of those suttas, the Buddha teaches the seven factors of awakening near the end of the suttas. And those suttas describe the development of a well-concentrated mind through shamatha vipassana meditation to support the refined mindfulness to hold in mind the Four Noble Truths, bringing an awakened human being, a fully mature human being. So the seven factors of awakening are significantly important qualities of mind to develop. The first factor, the first factor is mindfulness, as the first factor of awakening. And remember, they're a very specific type of mindfulness, mindfulness that leads to developing insight into the three marks of existence, mindfulness that is used to frame the Eightfold Path as the path to awakening. To hold that in mind, is that clear? Very specific mindfulness the Buddha taught. The second factor is investigation of the Dhamma. Investigation of the Dhamma is a factor of enlightenment. Investigation of the Dhamma is carefully taught by the Buddha. He's referring to himself here. Investigation of the Dhamma is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. And the Dhamma refers to not every single sutta that the Buddha ever taught, but developing the Dhamma means integrating the Eightfold Path as your path to awakening. Investigation of the Dhamma. Investigation of the Dhamma is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Investigation of the Dhamma brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. The next factor is persevering effort. Persevering effort is a factor of enlightenment. Persevering effort is carefully taught by the Buddha. Persevering effort is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Persevering effort brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. So it means we have to keep going. We have to continue. The sixth factor of the Eightfold Path is persevering effort or right effort, meaning that we have to keep ourselves focused on the Dhamma and within the framework of the Dhamma. Persevering effort, keep going. The next factor is joyful engagement, sometimes referred to as rapture, but rapture is a pretty archaic term and sometimes misunderstood. It means, in this case, joyful engagement. We're enraptured with the Dhamma, almost to the point where we just can't get enough of it. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma is a factor of enlightenment. Joyful engagement is carefully taught by the Buddha. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Joyful engagement in the Dhamma brings perfect understanding and full realization and nibbana. My comment here. Recognizing the singular importance that an awakened human being's teachings continue to be available brings joy and careful focus and avoids a conditioned mind's need to adapt and accommodate the purity of the Buddha's Dhamma. I know when I finally came across the Buddha's actual teachings, and then eventually realized that I was studying something that an awakened human being actually taught, not something that led to, in me, a lot of confusion and contradictions. It really was this a singularly remarkable point in my life, and I still remember what that feeling and that rapture that came over me, that I had finally discovered something that I could really put, I'm not going to say faith, that I could really put my conviction in and follow it to the end now. I mean, I had, in effect, I had finally taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma. I didn't quite have a well-focused Sangha yet. But that really changed anything. And it's still remarkable to me, and I know I say it here often, that these teachings that were first given 2,600 years ago by an awakened human being are still available to us in their pure form. And another remarkable fact of simply being a human being is that I have a mind that's able to understand and develop this. And it's not that I have any type of special mind. The Buddha taught this teachings for any human being who was interested. And he often said that if it was not possible for all of us to develop this awakening, he wouldn't teach it. The next factor of awakening is tranquility. Tranquility is a factor of awakening. Tranquility or enlightenment. Tranquility is carefully taught by the Buddha. Tranquility is cultivated and fully developed by an awakened human being. Tranquility brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. The Buddha is talking about that calm that's developed through understanding, but and also directly through meditation, which leads to the next factor. Concentration is a factor of enlightenment. Concentration is carefully taught by the Buddha. The Buddha teaches concentration as that eighth factor of the Eightfold Path. Right meditation develops a well-concentrated mind. It's the purpose of meditation. And you can see how that fits in with the seven factors of awakening now. Concentration is cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. Concentration brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. My words. Tranquility and concentration are both the focus, and purpose of shamatha vipassana meditation when practiced within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, equanimity is a factor of enlightenment. Equanimity is carefully taught by the Buddha. Equanimity is cultivated and fully developed by an awakened human being. Equanimity brings perfect understanding, full realization, and nibbana. So you've heard me say often that the final goal of the Eightfold Path is to develop right understanding, which is a profound understanding of the nature of suffering. And that quality of mind is last. Equanimity means something that is unchanging. It's balanced. It's resting in peace. Nothing can challenge it at that point, an awakened point. Now, remember when we talked about the jhanas, the seven levels of meditative absorption, equanimity is that last jhana. And so during meditation, we have experiences, most of us, of all four levels of meditative absorption, including that feeling of equanimity. That feeling that at least for the moment, our minds are at peace and nothing can challenge that peace. Of course, until we're there, then the next thought comes in and challenges that peace. Equanimity is the defining characteristic of an awakened mind. And do you see now how it fits in with, in general, the Buddha's teachings, but also very specifically in the culmination of the Eightfold Path and the culmination of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness and the, well, we'll get to it next week, and the proper development of meditation within the framework of breath awareness meditation. It's finally developed that mind of equanimity. The Buddha continues, these seven factors of enlightenment are carefully taught by the Buddha and all seven are cultivated and fully developed by one awakened. These seven factors of enlightenment bring perfect understanding, full realization, meaning a completely developed right view, full realization, and nibbana. Nibbana literally means to put the fire out, to extinguish. And you remember the I remember when I give these teachings, I think it was last Saturday or maybe last Thursday, on the fire discourse and those who were on retreat. Was it? It's putting out the fires of passion that would continue to establish self-referent wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. That's nibbana. That's the phrase nibbana means, to do that, to extinguish those, the fires of passion, the flames of ignorance. The Buddha continues, therefore, train yourselves to continue to abandon clinging to material gain, clinging to status, clinging to offerings, clinging to unskillful ambitions, and clinging to unskillful associations. It's the end of the sutta. Clinging in general. Again, the Buddha describes an awakened mind as a mind that is free of clinging. It's released from clinging. And notice that list. That list kind of covers everything that a self-referential ego self would cling itself to establish an ego. Material gain, power, our associations that we use to describe ourselves, and everything that follows from that, whether that's within Dhamma practice, or maybe I should call it spiritual practice, whether it's within a well-focused Sangha, or just in ordinary life, the things that we associate with. And once we form those associations, if they're rooted in ignorance, we'll go to great extremes to defend those associations, don't we? It creates a lot of conflict in the world. That's what the Buddha described in the Loka Sutta when he looked out on the world from his now awakened point of view and said the world is a flame. Leads right back to nibbana, putting out those flames, doesn't it? So these seven factors of awakening are something to begin to integrate into our practice and also recognize the direction that they give, such as investigation of the Dhamma, and also see those as a quality of mind, something that we develop within ourselves. This is a direct approach that the Buddha taught, rather than worship and devotion, which is related more to religion than what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a direct practice of cultivating the qualities necessary to recognize and abandon conditioned thinking, thinking rooted in wrong views. And these are the direct steps that the Buddha taught. Next week, hopefully, when we start talking about and referencing the Anapanasutta, you'll see a slightly more detailed way where the Buddha is actually teaching, developing these different qualities of mind. But it's also, we talked about it in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness too. That's the end of tonight's talk. Any questions related to tonight's talk, and then we'll go around the room. Lorna first. Yep.
First two, mindfulness and the investigation of the Dhamma. I think I'm confused about those two, because I think about the Dhamma, but I think I'm just replacing conditioned thinking with thinking about the Dhamma. In as much as I'm not thinking about it in a practical way or a educational way, or, you know, I think about coming here, or I think about you, or, which is not, you know, it's not really the Dhamma. And I think I spend more time, what I would call conditioned thinking, thinking about the Dhamma. You're laughing.
I'm smiling because you're actually describing great insight.
I get into that. And you could call it investigation of the Dhamma also, thinking about the Dhamma, but it's not what the Buddha meant.
Isn't it the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it?
Yes, but what Lorna, what you're describing is a well-framed Dhamma practice that is still being impacted by a touch of conditioned thinking, and that touch of conditioned thinking is doubt, and it's a self-reflective doubt. Mm-hmm. You are fully engaged as anyone could be in developing the Dhamma, But there's an aspect of your conditioned thinking that is giving rise to doubt in that way. So how do you overcome that? Through persevering effort. The next factor of awakening. And isn't it interesting how the Buddha taught that and recognized that even someone who is developing mindfulness and whose conviction is bringing investigation into the Dhamma, and yet doubt could arise. What do you do? Continue with your effort, really. I mean, that's all that you can do. And recognize that the doubt is simply a self-referential judgment of yourself. It's a convenient way of keeping conditioned thinking going. Yeah. And it's not... it's not right or wrong in a skillful or unskillful way. It's just an aspect of developing the Dhamma. Or there wouldn't be such a thing, relating it directly to this sutta, there wouldn't be a mention of persevering effort. And remember, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path to overcome the common human problem of conditioned thinking, wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And it's an aspect of conditioned thinking to create many scenarios that would allow it to ignore its own ignorance. And one of those great ones, a powerful one is doubt. It's even mentioned as one of the five common hindrances, isn't it? So you show great insight, and even the insight to recognize that it's something that's holding you back at this point. And so what do you do with it? When the Buddha teaches the five hindrances, when we recognize they arise during meditation practice, what does he suggest we do?
Go back to your breath. That's what I try to do. When I realize what I am doing, I think, no, this is not really what I should be doing. I should be just, you know, mellowing out and thinking about your breath and not having your mind churn, go from one to the other, because that's just thinking, really.
Yep. And again, even the initial thought that I doubt I'm doing this right can then lead to a whole chain of thoughts, a whole train of thoughts, one thought following another, right. And getting into where I'm getting off, how am I getting off base, maybe this isn't going to work for me, maybe I just can't do it. And all of that is just conditioned thinking. And this, in meditation, we come back to the sensation of breathing. Off our cushion, the same is true, but then we also... off our cushion, understand that we need to develop the broader framework of the Eightfold Path, specifically for that reason. If we just rely on a meditation practice, and some schools just teach that, just meditate, what do you do when doubt arises? You have no frame of reference to even recognize what's occurring. In fact, some schools teach you to cultivate doubt. I don't know why. The Buddha never taught to cultivate doubt. He taught to recognize it and come back to the sensation of breathing. Don't let it in. Don't let it lead to further distraction, which is just what you're doing. So, did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up, Stefan.
Tranquility and equanimity sound awfully similar to me. Are we supposed to understand the difference between those factors?
It's a really good question. And we never want to get too analytical with anything because that can just lead to more distraction. You could look at tranquility, developing tranquility, as a direct act within meditation. And equanimity is the more subtle but lasting effect of a mind that is training itself in tranquility. Another word for shamatha is tranquility or calm. So it's the tranquility that we are able to establish, and even the third jhana indirectly references tranquility. So it's something that we can cultivate until we get to the point where our minds are resting in equanimity, meaning an awakened mind. There's nothing left that can shake that mind in that level of equanimity. But there's a preliminary development of a calm and peaceful mind. And that's why the Buddha teaches it as a factor, almost as a stepping stone towards awakening. This will become even more clear well, through the seven foundations, through the four foundations of mindfulness that we went through over the summer, and then beginning next week in the Anapanasati Sutta, because the Buddha directs it, addresses it in a similar way like that, as a development. And so all of the Dhamma is a way of developing our minds. Developing our minds within our body, meaning united with our body. In the suttas, when we really understand this, the breath in the body, the Buddha's teaching not something that is completely mental, but a way to integrate the mind and the body as one unit, as a complete factor for awakening. It's not something that we're looking to escape, and it's not just dealing with mental fabrications. In both of the suttas that I've mentioned and other suttas, the Buddha doesn't talk just about mental fabrications, does he? He talks about mental fabrications, and then even verbal fabrications, and then bodily fabrications are things that we need to address. And how do we do it? Matt really knows what I'm talking about, because that's kind of the essence of Tai Chi and Qigong, isn't it? How to unite the body into the mind through very deliberate movements. The Dhamma is the same way. It allows us to unite. A distracted mind, a self-referential mind, is continually focused outside of its own body, isn't it? When you really start understanding the nature of distraction, self-referential thoughts are always outside of the body. And that's really the underlying cause of stress, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
when we're not where we are, stress arises. And we can't be where we are, which is right here, when my mind is out there, isn't it? And when I've established myself in self-referential views, that's what that phrase means, self-referential views. I have external views that I'm using to reference myself. I like chocolate. I like oak trees. I like you. I don't like that. I can't wait till I get my new car. What's going to happen at work tomorrow? All these scenarios that we come up with that are self-referential, that are always externally focused. The Dhamma, when fully developed, unites the body and the mind as one unit to awaken without any self-referential views. So, boy, I really went off on that, didn't I? I hope I answered your question about tranquility and equanimity.
Yeah.
So tranquility is a preliminary stage towards uniting the mind and body in a state of ongoing equanimity. I could have said that earlier and saved myself a lot. So. Nash, you had a question?
I did, and then you said something about being too analytical. And I figured that might be what I was doing.
That's okay.
But I guess I'll just bring it up so I'm
please
stewing on it. when you were saying, when you talk about associations a lot, I was thinking about how, you said unskillful associations, and I couldn't quite understand that, I guess, because the way I understand associations is us creating, associating ourselves with things, and creating this self-referential ego self through the things we associate and the things that we like, and so I guess the first part of my question, are there skillful associations?
Absolutely.
And there are.
Yes.
So what we're doing here, I'll just speak for myself, what I'm doing and coming here and associating myself with the Dhamma, I'm not just associating myself with something else. I'm not wording it right because it's jumbled in my mind, but I don't know. I guess it's just the doubt of being worried that I'm not doing it right, or that I'm substituting my associations that weren't this with this.
Yes, it's similar to what Lauren was talking about, but it's also, and this isn't being too analytical. What I meant by that, before I answer your question. A mind that wants to continue to ignore its own ignorance will come up with all kinds of scenarios in its own mind why things don't work the way that the way that they were explained in the Dhamma. You can always find an exception to anything if you want to pick things apart too much. The way we... That's why the Buddha said ehipasiku. You have to experience this for yourself to know its efficacy. So getting directly to your question, skillful associations within the Dhamma are associations with people that are well focused on the Dhamma. That's what the Buddha's talking about in that sense, in skillful associations. During the Buddha's time, there was just as much opportunity for distraction and confusing dharmas as there are now. And so the Buddha was teaching his monks and nuns that if you want to develop the Dhamma, you associate with like-minded people. Then in a practical sense, you want to be wise in your associations, just because who and what we associate with is going to determine to a great extent the quality of our own life. Now, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have, using a common word, we should vet everybody that we interact with. That's not what associations mean. Just talking to someone is not an association. Creating an identity with someone or with a group or with an idea or an ideology is an association. Another type of association is the things that we like, and we create identities. I always use chocolate cake. I'm a chocolate cake lover. You know, if that rises to the level where I need to have a piece of chocolate cake once a week or once a month or once a day, I'm in trouble, because I'm setting myself up for disappointing, using a silly argument. But it's that type of an association that we're talking about too. So wise associations within the Dhamma are people that are well focused on the Dhamma. Wise associations in life are people that are living wholesome and well-balanced life. And I'll give you an extreme example, but a very useful example from my own life, my own history. I'm a recovered drug addict and alcoholic. The first thing they told me, I was 19 years old, I think, 26. 19 was the first time they told me this, 26. I didn't listen to them. I was too enamored with my associations to listen at the time. The first thing they told me was that you have to change, everybody said, people, places, and things. You have to change your associations if you hope to recover. And of course, if you're like I was, everybody you know drank and drugged like I did. And so if I didn't change those associations, no matter how much I wanted to stay sober, and by that time I was done, there was no way I could have, because everybody around me is doing the same thing. A few years after that, I met a guy named Riley Reagan. He's this great guy. And he used to say this. He was I don't get into the long. He used to speak a lot in the AA circles. They call him a circuit speaker. And he'd always say this. He says, if you're sitting in a room and you look behind you and there's a duck, and you look to your right, there's a duck, and to the left, there's a duck, and in front of you, there's a duck, it's a good chance you're a duck. Meaning that whoever you associate with, you are going to develop those tendencies. And this is the type of thing that the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago, the importance of recognizing our associations with, again, putting the emphasis on the Dhamma. If we hope to develop the Dhamma as the Buddha taught his Dhamma, we'll associate ourselves with people that are doing that, and we'll associate ourselves with his Dhamma unencumbered and unembellished. Again, that's what the Buddha was talking. Even during the Buddha's time, there were monks and nuns that would go out into the countryside, and they'd meet other teachers and other influences, and they'd bring them back in, and they'd say, what about this? What do you think of this? And this person's teaching that. And develop the Eightfold Path. Associate yourself with the Dhamma. That's enough. And isn't it enough? So it's a very important question that you ask. Please.
Another part of that is... And I'm not trying to sound like a skeptic, or I'm trying, but like, I just want to understand. I guess just in my own mind, there would be a tendency, or like just a subconscious thing, to have aversions to people that aren't well-focused in the Dhamma, and that's something that we're trying to avoid. And it just, I don't know, and it almost seems like I'm almost like clinging to the Dhamma, and I don't know why I'm so confused. Do you know why I'm so confused? Because I haven't been meditating.
Ah!
And,
So you're not associating yourself with the Dhamma.
Yeah. And, like, my meditation practice has just been very poor lately. And I've noticed, like, in when I try to, you know, apply the Dhamma that I can't. It's not that I can't. It's just that it's really hard.
Yeah, it feels like it's beyond your grasp at the moment. Yeah.
It's really, like, I just don't have the concentration. And it's easier to just be apathetic and to just...
Yeah, so persevering effort is an important part of the Dhamma, isn't it? Or right effort as the sixth factor of the Eightfold Path. I mean, I think you're answering your own question, but so an important aspect of the Eightfold Path is meditation, so that we can have a relatively well-concentrated mind to support the other factors, including right effort. You know, a distracted mind cannot engage in right effort, period. Can't do it. It'll find all kinds of scenarios why this thing doesn't work. And now you mentioned aversion to people that aren't associated with the Dhamma. Aversion is the other side of the same coin of clinging or craving. And so not everybody has to be engaged in the Dhamma. And if they're not, I don't need to have an aversion towards them. I accept it. It's simply the way it is. Not everybody, even during the Buddha's time, the Buddha didn't see himself as a savior or his philosophy as salvific. In other words, everybody has to develop it or they're going to all burn in hell. He taught the people that were interested. That's all. And so if you're interested in developing awakening as the Buddha teaches awakening, then you associate yourself with the Eightfold Path. Again, the important distinction in associations is if you want to develop the Eightfold Path, you associate with the Eightfold Path. If you want to develop something else, and we're all free to do whatever we want, then we associate with something else. The whole point of all of this, even you could say every sutta the Buddha ever gave, and hopefully every class that I ever give, is to recognize a singular importance and the completeness of the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths. That's why I say over and over again, everything the Buddha taught for his 45-year teaching career was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths. He never taught anything else. That doesn't mean that we can't engage in other things if we want. And this maybe is probably the most difficult thing that I have in getting across and not sounding intolerant, because I don't mean to be that way. But an awakened human being taught his Dhamma, and he taught a complete Dhamma. It's enough. It's when we need to add to it or embellish it in any way that the Dhamma itself becomes ineffective. And it's just that way. It's not, you know, it's just that way. And it's because of the nature of anatta, a self rooted in wrong views, that the Eightfold Path was taught and needs to be followed the way it's taught. Because a mind rooted in wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, will continue to create very subtle but powerful strategies to continue to ignore its own ignorance. Doubt is one of them. I mean, that's one of the five hindrances. And that, you know, that's just the way it is. So, really, wow, important questions, all of you. Any, Isabel?
If, like that, right, and what you just said, what if the Dhamma is enough, but you have these interests in other things, not as a means of awakening, not as clinging on to them, but they're just an interest, they're just something as a human experience. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying, and I can understand where the confusion might be coming from. We're human beings. We're here to live a full human life, and that means all the other experiences. The Dhamma is not the only thing that we should be focused on. That would become, for someone living outside of a monastery setting, when you join a monastery, you're making a commitment to just be focused on the Dhamma. That is something different. For those of us living secular lives, there's a secular life to be lived. the framework of the Eightfold Path then, as we develop it, becomes a framework for all of our activities, which could be anything. And it might be something you might enjoy chanting. Chanting is not something the Buddha ever taught, but enjoy your chanting. Just understand that it's not something that is directly part of the Dhamma that the Buddha taught. You might enjoy yoga. Yoga is not something that the Buddha taught, but yoga is a mostly healthy thing. Notice how I say that. If you do a Google search on yoga injuries, you're going to see thousands and thousands of pages of people getting hurt. So it's not a completely harmless. It's the only reason I'm saying. That's why I say, come to Matt's class and learn Tai Chi and Qigong. To me, the philosophy is more in line. But do you understand what I'm saying? We're here to have...
Yeah, I think my question, it just like comes from... Because I'm a student and I'm studying psychology and learning all these things. So it's, I guess that's where it comes from, like following... I'm developing the Dhamma and the Eightfold Path and then integrating it into these other aspects of my life and finding and realizing that, like, you know, this, it is enough. Like, I'm not looking to expand or add more to it. That's not looking to expand on the Dhamma. Like, I understand. I love the Dhamma for what it is. You know, I'm not looking to add more to it. I find peace within what I have, but I also...
I know what you're saying, and
but
so...
the other things I do have interest in don't necessarily cause, like, confusion, or...
No.
Yeah.
Your developing understanding of the Eightfold Path can only enhance your whatever else you're learning. And if you end up being a therapist of some kind... The mindfulness and the framework for understanding the nature of suffering can only enhance your ability as a therapist. And so there's no conflict there. The conflict becomes when you try to adapt the Dhamma into a broad psychological practice and say that the Dhamma taught some type of psychology, and that's often done. Even sometimes the Buddha is mentioned as the great psychologist. There you're mixing things up too much. So what you're describing to me is it's very clear in your mind what the Dhamma is and what other interests are and other studies are. That's wonderful. You know, even during the Buddha's time, every strata of society learn from the Buddha, and many of them awakened and continued with whatever their interest was. I mean, one that comes to mind is Anatha Pandika, who is a very wealthy businessman. He met the Buddha, he studied with the Buddha, he awakened, and he continued in his business endeavors. He didn't just turn away from everything else that he was interested in, and that allowed him to also support the Buddha financially for many, many years.
Yeah, maybe I think I might just get a fear that because I'm so new in developing the Dhamma that my conditioned mind might steer me away, I think. And I don't know if there's really anything to say to that other than, you know, continue developing the Dhamma, but.
The framework of the Eightfold Path will prevent getting sidetracked by worldly pursuits, but there's nothing wrong with worldly pursuits. As we develop awakening, as our minds become more well concentrated, more peaceful, more well focused on what's occurring in the moment, we're simply much more effective in whatever we choose to do. And of course, if our endeavors in the beginning, as we begin Dhamma practice, weren't, I'm talking about right livelihood right now. Right livelihood within the framework of the Eightfold Path is there because the Buddha acknowledges that we're going to be out engaging in livelihood. And the framework of the Eightfold Path allows us to do that in a very mindful and peaceful way, causing no harm for others or ourselves. So, it, again, even right livelihood wouldn't be there if it wasn't acknowledged that we're going to be likely engaged in commerce in some way.
If you're studying psychology, the meditation and the Dhamma will help you recognize ego and all the other parts of conditioned thinking. Mm-hmm. They can all, you know, augment each other, really.
Plus, I've noticed in my own studies, psychology, that that particular study has a pretty powerful influence on developing a self-referential mind. So the Dhamma is a really good antidote for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And I think that's where I was like saying that fear with that is kind of, developed more. Because obviously at least what I've experienced, they're not they're not coming from like a space of developing the Dhamma when they're teaching.
Oh, there's aspects of the, and I'm talking very broad terms, of this psychological model that contradict a lot of what the Buddha teaches. But that doesn't mean it should be excluded from someone who's developed the Eightfold Path. You can only bring mindfulness and understanding to that model. And just like in any business model, one of our Sangha members, maybe I won't mention his name, but I think you all understand, is a personal injury lawyer. And he has brought such a level of mindfulness to that entire field, not just his own practice. He's now written papers for other lawyers in the field that are looking at this. So personal injury lawyers are usually, they're often seen in a very negative light until you need one, and then you're glad you got a good one, right? Well, I mean, it's just true. So this gentleman has brought his Dhamma practice and his understanding of mindfulness and the Eightfold Path directly into his practice. And some of the things that he talks about, and even real court cases, are remarkable. And again, he's written some papers for the state bar. They're looking at it. So that type of effect happens, where someone who's saying and would misinterpret the idea of be mindful of your association and say, how could you be a lawyer? How could you do that and practice the Dhamma? Of course you can. If any field needs mindfulness, well, it's not just that. I mean, just about any field of endeavor today could use a measure of the Eightfold Path, couldn't it? It only enhances it. So, and again, bringing it back to that, and really good questions too about associations. Bringing it back to that, it doesn't mean that we should live this cloistered, confined life, but we should be mindful of who and what we're associating with. And how do we know? How do we tell what's a skillful association? Use the Eightfold Path. Does it fit in with all the factors of the Eightfold Path? And if it doesn't, it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be exposed to it. We should simply stop associating ourselves with it. And that can help us extricate ourselves from hurtful social associations that would otherwise be difficult to remove ourselves from. And getting back to my example, So what did I do? I said, the hell with it. I went back to the bars and stuff. It was a very difficult thing to do initially. But that idea of association at that point, I wasn't aware of association. But that saved my life. Because if I didn't, the people that knew me then said, you're not going to make 30. Because of my association. Well, not just because of where my associations were taking me. So that was a very important point in me being here 35, 37 years later. Associations, just a practical example of that.
I think associations are extremely important. People who have dementia, they're finding out, get dementia because they've been abused. And they stay with people who abuse them. And so the natural psychological bent is to just, you know, space out. Leave your mind. Or, you know, go inside or whatever. I think associations, I mean, is a really major, important part of this. Of life, really. And I don't, anyway.
Yeah, thank you. We all know stories of people in very hurtful situations, but because of the habitual familiarity of it, they just can't leave. That's what I mean. We within the framework of the Eightfold Path, we learn to extricate ourselves.
Women get stuck in a marriage because they can't go out and earn, you know, a living, you know, of especially a couple of years, you know, many years marriage and stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And again, getting it back to the focus on the Dhamma, we have a complete practice. You know, that's why the Buddha reinforced that over and over again, emphasize it. You know, associate yourself with the Dhamma. So let's go around the room. Ram, good to see you.
I was listening just a little bit ago about having trouble with his meditation and also with right effort. I found that actually that the meditation practice, establishing that, is a really good focal point for getting your right effort together as well.
Oh yeah.
Are really interconnected very strongly.
Yeah. I often refer to the Eightfold Path as a complete practice. You leave any one of those factors out, it's not likely to work very well. You know, you need meditation, but meditation also needs the other factors to keep it focused. Thank you. Stefan, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I'm fine. I pass.
I'm glad you're here. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. Really great class.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for you know, pulling something out of your own experience and sharing it. That's really what the Sangha is. So
yeah.
Thanks for participating that way. Just a little bit about learning and studying things and being a student. You're going to learn a lot of things. You're going to learn a lot of different things based on your setting and your environment and what your interests are. You're not going to be able to use it all. And that's okay. So, it's very important to develop what you resonate with and cultivate that. Because there are going to be some things that are great things that you won't use. And that's not because they're not useful. They're just not useful for you. So, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, it's supposed to be like that. So, hopefully the Dhamma is that for you.
There's a wise man.
Yeah.
Isabel, anything you'd like to add? Or?
Just thank you. Thank you to everyone.
Thank you for being a part of our Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. Nash.
I guess I just want to say thank you as well, because it is kind of, I mean, I do really try to be gentle with myself, and even though it's only been like 4 or 5 days that I haven't meditated, it's still kind of like embarrassing, or like I'm a little bit upset at myself, or there'd be like a tendency to do that, and I'm just really grateful that amongst all the people that really take the Dhamma seriously, that I feel like I can say that and not feel like excluded because I haven't developed as much. I am still very new to this. I just appreciate how accepting everyone is.
We certainly are. We're glad you're part of our Sangha. has anybody here ever missed 4 or 5 days of meditation? Thank you. Here, David, welcome to our sangha, our physical sangha.
When I started my practice, I had been reading, so I kind of had a framework. And one of the things I knew I can control was my effort and my energy and my investigation. So literally every morning I wake up and I say to myself, come, see. And I always thought that was in line with right effort and investigation.
Yeah.
But recently, 2 months, I just have become very aware that there's a joyful nature of this pursuit. And all the other things that concentration and mindfulness and equanimity, that will come with time. But the things I can control were those three things. So that's been my approach. So.
Boy, thank you so much for that. It is such, I mean, you know, the Buddha mentioned it a few times, joyful engagement with the Dhamma. We should be joyful. We found the answer, you know. Again, that's the most remarkable thing and the thing that I'm most, I consider myself most fortunate to have come across, that these teachings are still here, and that we have minds to develop it, you know. We can do it. Thank you. Mary, good to see you.
Oh, good to be here. Good to be here with David.
Yeah.
I don't have a lot to say, but just have been really focused on right effort, but also, for whatever reason, thinking more about the integration off the cushion a lot more, you know, like really putting an effort into, like really every moment of my day. Like it's not separate, where at different times it's been separate, something I do in the morning, something I do at night, and then bits and pieces of it during the day. But lately it's been very concentrated on this is how I'm living my life. And, you know, feeling the good feeling you get about doing that, but also seeing the frequency at which you're thinking about it. It's just been wonderful. So it's awesome.
Thank you so much for that. Glad you're here. Diane, good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here. It's good to hear. One of the things I feel compelled to say is I don't think an infant or maybe an infant really is it already in the Dhamma. And then we teach
the
conditioned thinking. And so, I mean, psychologically, it's almost like you have to have an identity of some kind before you can let it go. And anyway, that's that. When I was on my sojourn in Arizona for 2.5 months this summer, fall, I overdid it with some of the muscles in my feet and legs. And is it okay? Anyway, I'm going to do this anyway. how the practice has helped me is, this thing, I want what I want when I want it, you know, I want to feel good now. I want these muscles to feel good now. And the more I said that, the more tense I got. Meditating, and I resented meditation because it was uncomfortable no matter what way I sat. And anyway, I did meditate, and one thing came out of the meditation at one time was, I love my feet just the way they are. I love my feet just the way they are. It eventually gentled out a little bit, but it was a beginning.
Gentled out, I like that.
It was a beginning for me. And this physical pain, I mean, it really keeps you, in the now. And I also found myself warring to get out of the physical pain. I want to get in my head so I can, not feel the pain or something like that. And then what all the homeopathic stuff that I needed to take care of the issue, my feet and the muscles in my legs, were, you know, okay, but they weren't really doing anything. I mean, it wasn't happening fast enough, I guess. So I started taking ibuprofen and some of the over-the-counter creams and stuff like that. And that felt good for a little bit. And then didn't get anywhere at all. That really kind of was a plateaued out, and I thought, this is not gonna, and I thought maybe somebody intimated it at work that maybe I had cancer and it was in the bones or something like that.
A lot of associations.
Yeah. And I rejected that. Yes. I thought, no, I'm not gonna go there. And anyway, but like that night, I started rubbing my feet with castor oil. And I'm sure everybody's heard deep massages. Well, I was like giving my feet and my legs and my backside deep massages where it hurt. I mean, like, wow. But then I slept like a log that night. The next day, I woke up feeling good. This is my process that I'm explaining. But the thing that really came through to me is when you were just saying a couple minutes ago something about it, you know, being in the body, as I found these knots, these, you know, deep places where I hurt when I massaged my heel and it hurt, it was like thoughts came up of times in my life and stuff like that that was like real. And it's been a process of, I know that Buddha didn't come to heal us, but this is, it's healing my mind as I like heal my body. And it's, now I am thankful that I couldn't walk for days. And boy, when you can't walk, going to the bathroom is a major accomplishment for the hour or whatever. But anyway, it's just this accepting life as it is. Boy, it's so powerful.
Thank you. Bonnie, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, good to be back. And I think I resonate with a lot of things that have come up, and I'm just grateful for the Eightfold Path to help me and to help my livelihood and my own healing and getting healthy. And
thank you. May I ask, as you've integrated the Eightfold Path into your professional life, it has it has enhanced it?
It's been sort of remarkable because it's helped me to name. It just feels like how I've practiced for the past 4 decades has been. It's weird. It's like using the framework, but not in a particular order. Knowing that it was there. I mean, I've had dabbling with meditation and friendships with people who had saunas and invited me before I was fully ready to be at a silent retreat all day, and I came home. You know, nobody would talk to me. But so the Eightfold Path has really helped me to name the concepts and how I want to live my life and how I engage with work and my students and their clients. And I think the one biggest thing, too, is compassion for not being so hard.
Mm.
And that's been probably one of my biggest reliefs, being here now. Maybe I was it like 4 or 5 years, something. So 4 years, 3 years, something like that.
Yeah.
But it says the compassion, which allows me then to even be more fully present, and to, because part of it is being able to sit with people's pain, I don't know, maybe a month ago, or I don't know how long ago, you talked about how the Eightfold Path isn't something that you, we just, like, you know, when we're learning, we learn one thing, and then we learn that, and we apply it to the next thing, and it's consecutive, where it feels so, like, you know, a ladder only works if all the rungs are there, right? It's kind of like a complete ladder, almost, in some way. So that's a relief, too, because if I'm feeling like, for me also, in this past month, I've been thinking about karma, not karma, like, oh, my next life, but what's going on with me in my body that I'm carrying the stuff that, and I think sometimes too, as a therapist, when I, if you take in, there's this thing called secondary re-traumatization, so you have to be really careful. So I think in a way, it's like really having to be really as fully awake and present, because especially if, you know, we can't change things. You know, Diane's talking about accepting things as they are. I can't make things different for people or for myself. Well, actually, I can make different choices the more I become awake and, you know, have skillful intention and view and so forth. So it's been really, I don't need to prattle on, but I guess I could prattle on, because it's been really... that's amazing. And before you said something about, you know, not seeing the Dharma as this psychological base, but I think so much of the cognitive world did learn from this.
Yeah.
I mean, it, you know, not, and I keep thinking, where did he get it from, you know, 2,600 years ago? Because I think really so much of the cognitive work really comes directly out of this. So maybe it... And it doesn't have to be religion or, a theory, but it's practice, really very specific cognitive-based skills that we practice and we get stronger. So if I go to the gym and I lift my weights once, unfortunately, that's not enough. I have to keep going back, which I hate, you know. But so that if, you know, it's like practice, so by practicing it all, I get stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I don't do it, I'm a little weak, but then I have to be kind and say, okay, I'll start with the 1 pound, maybe. Maybe get to the 10, but anyway.
Thank you. I'm glad I asked that question. There's no doubt that the ideas of mindfulness and self-compassion have been integrated into modern psychology, and that's just wonderful. The problem arises when that is then presented as Buddhist practice. That's where it gets lost, rather than seeing it the other way around. That, you know, and that is truly integrating the Eightfold Path into the modern world in a very useful way. You know, you could say that John Kabat-Zinn probably did it most effectively with MBS, a mindfulness-based stress reduction. And he was always very clear that this is not a teaching of the Buddha. This is an adaptation that works very well, beautifully well, in that application.
Right, with many different choices also within that.
Yeah, and quite a few people that come here first went to MBSR, and then a few people went to MBSR from here. There's no conflict in that. You know, at all, except when you try to say it's the same thing, but it's not presented that way. And you need to come on our retreats. They're not silent retreats.
Oh my God, that was so
fun. Liz, good to see you. How are you?
You too. And I went on a retreat that had silent days, and my friend
who I'd gone with felt that whispering was a lot. And that if she held her hand over her mouth, she'd talk to me. And I'm trying to be silent. And she gets a phone put in our room. Anyway, it was quite an experience. Bending the Dharma to work in your case. I think it's wonderful to see people much younger than me starting with John. You have no idea how much you're skipping in finding John, because there's so many ways to get lost on the path by distractions.
Wandering around.
So I don't know if anyone has caught this, but on CNN, a reaction to the whole idea of fake news has this amazing commercial out right now. And it starts out, and there's an apple sitting in the middle of the space, and there's nothing around it. And it says, comes out and says, this is an apple. And then a set of wind-up dentures comes out across the stage in front of the apple, and they say, this is a distraction. And then they say, this is still an apple.
Oh,
that's amazing. And then they have another one that I don't remember as well, but I was, you know, I've been watching the news probably too much lately. It's like, you know, it's like you get that old feeling of watching Watergate, you know, it's coming back. But anyway, so what's happening with me is my practice is getting a little bit better. I had kind of fallen off the path for a while in terms of a real devoted practice of twice a day. But a funny thing happened last night. I was asking my husband a question about something difficult that was happening, and I was asking him to talk about it, and he said, I can't, it's the second arrow. And I just started cracking up, and I said, oh, yeah, that, but just tell me, you know, what your suffering is, and I was just, it was really funny. So he's picking up on things that I've been talking about, and these guys all know him, so he's, you know, that's pretty impressive. So, I look forward to getting back into my meditation. I'm doing some more reading. Again, thank you, John, for putting this all together in such a simple yet not easy way of interpreting a way to live your life in a skillful manner that can end suffering.
Thank you, Liz, for those kind words. You know, when you say it, I got to say that this wouldn't be possible without Matt, though, too. He's such an important part of Cross River Meditation Center, and that it's ongoing presence here. You know? So, thank you, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
From all of us, and also all of you. You know, this is really a remarkable sangha, not because of who the teacher is, but because of the sangha. You know, sangha is more than one person. So thank you all. I'll leave it at that. Lorna, good to see you.
I'll start with my meditation practice. I think my meditation practice is changing in the fact that my mind is changing when I meditate, that I can stay present with my breath a lot easier than I've ever been able to do before. And also, lightheartedly, be able to think at the same time, but not lose track of my breath. It's not a thinking that's deep or anything like that. But I can, my mind just can come. Well, I'm going to say come away from my breath. It doesn't come away from my breath. It parts
from my breath. That's a better way of describing it. And that's has happened since I've extended my practice to half an hour twice a day. And I struggled with the half hour right from the beginning. I struggled with doing the half hour. To me now it's a piece of cake. Half an hour is nothing. I've quickly put on another 10 minutes and got used to that time very, very quickly. Quite surprised in a good way. So I think my actual sits on the cushion are doing very well. I still wish that I could see the Dharma more clearly in my day-to-day life. See I wish I could see the Dharma more clearly in the day-to-day life and for the Dharma to be more useful to me in my day-to-day life. I'm still not seeing when I go off track and I go down the story or what you've just described of preferential thoughts are always outside your body. When I'm sitting here, I see that, but I can't carry that, those thoughts and those teachings through into my daily life. I look for the Dharma and think about the Dharma. And that's what I do. I think about the Dharma. Not always the teachings of the Dharma and the wisdom of the Dharma and the, you know, all that sort of stuff that we are coming to learn. I'm not mindful enough to bring those teachings to the fore of my mind to see it in my day-to-day life. And that frustrates me. But, you know, I'm on the path and I am good at this, otherwise I wouldn't need to come to class. So I guess that's why I come to class, to learn it all, you know, so just a gentleman myself. And just to add to what Bonnie was saying about how it's helped her be gentle with herself, my Dharma practice has helped me enormously to be gentle with myself, just to be allowing myself to be myself and not find fault with myself as I was in the past.
Good.
Because I was told when I was a little girl, for years and years and years, that I wasn't right. And it stuck. And the Dharma has helped me see that I am exactly as I should be. And this is how I am.
Yeah, without embellishment. Good for you.
Yeah.
And Lorna, you are describing, you're going to get a lot out of the Anapanasati Sutta. I hope I get to it next week, because the Buddha describes this process of developing mindfulness, meaning simply being able to think about the Dhamma in appropriate ways. Doesn't mean you have it all down instantly. And hopefully when you awaken, probably next week or the week after, you'll continue to come to the Sangha.
I'm counting on it.
Don't
leave
me.
I'm sitting here. Sitting right next to her.
Thank you. We'll finish with the with metta, as we always do. I made the announcement about the Truth to Happiness course starting soon. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a remarkable class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.